Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Biden's speech today at the birthplace of American democracy in Philadelphia, in which he attacked Trump's big lie that underpins the massive Republican voter suppression efforts underway, calling the GOP's gaming of the electoral playing field, quote, the most significant test of our democracy since the Civil War. Joining us is Joshua Douglas, a professor of law at the University of Kentucky College of Law, who teaches and researches election law and voting rights, and is the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. We'll discuss how the Supreme Court has all but closed off the courts for redress against voter suppression, and that it is now up to the Congress to deal with the Republican assault on voting rights underway. The urgency of the moment was highlighted by the presence of a delegation of Texas Democrats who came to Washington after walking out of the Texas legislature for a second time in desperation to stop the passage of nakedly partisan bills designed to prevent the majority from voting so that a minority can cling to power. Then we'll speak with Gary Pierre-Pierre, a Haitian-born Pulitzer Prize-winning multimedia and entrepreneurial journalist who left the New York Times in 1999 to launch the Haitian Times, a New York-based English-language weekly publication serving the Haitian diaspora. He joins us to discuss the failure of our press in repeating rather than questioning reports coming from Haitian officials and politicians vying for power whose claims about who was behind the assassination of President Moïse are completely lacking in credibility. Then finally, we'll examine the predictable crackdown on protesters in Cuba, with the shaken communist leaders resorting to their familiar tools of repression and tired revolutionary slogans, as police and army flood the streets of the major cities after the anti-government uprisings that erupted over the weekend. Cuban-born Ada Ferrer, a professor of history and Latin American and Caribbean studies at New York University, whose forthcoming book is Cuba, an American History, who has been traveling to and conducting research in Cuba since 1990, joins us. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, Joshua Douglas, who's a professor of law at the University of Kentucky College of Law, who teaches and researches election law and voting rights, civil procedure, constitutional law, and judicial decision-making. He is the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. And he has an article at CNN, Supreme Court Deals Blow to American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Douglas.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Josh. And the Supreme Court's recent decision gutting Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, 8 years after Chief Justice John Roberts gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, does that mean that what happened today with President Biden speaking in Philadelphia, urged on by the Texas legislature's Democrats who had to leave town for a second time to avoid a hideous set of voting restrictions becoming into law in Texas, does that mean that the courts are closed off, the DOJ has limited powers and abilities, and now it's up to Congress? Is it that clear that that's where we stand in terms of voting rights in this country?
Well, I wouldn't say that the courts are completely closed off to protecting the right to vote, but the Supreme Court's decision 2 weeks ago makes it really hard for the Department of Justice and for other plaintiffs to win. Because what the court did was it took a part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, and basically said, here are five factors to consider. And every one of those factors makes it really hard for plaintiffs to win.
But on top of that, Justice Alito referred to fraud. And fraud is this canard, this straw man that the Republicans have been using as an excuse to enact voter restrictions across the country. And there was no evidence of fraud in the last election.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how this notion of fraud has become such the dominant talking point that it's almost as if you say it enough times, people will believe it, and it justifies, according to the courts, really restrictive voting rules. And of course, if you say, well, there's no fraud out there, the response is, well, prove it. But how do you prove a negative? And so it's this cycle where, you know, it's Republican legislatures primarily who are saying we need to prevent fraud, and, you know, really stemming also from the big lie that suggests that Trump actually won the 2020 election, using that notion to justify more restrictive voting rules. And then you have the courts upholding them because they say, well, even if there isn't actual evidence of fraud, it's possible that it would occur. So it's really difficult to protect the right to vote given these multiple attacks from various different angles on the most foundational, fundamental right in our democracy.
And the Republicans in the Texas legislature, in defending this latest round of voting restrictions, which the Democrats walked away from to deny them a quorum, and are now in Washington and in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact, urging President Biden on, the Republicans have even admitted that there's no fraud, but they're saying they're enacting these laws in case there's fraud in the future. I mean, how thin is that?
Yeah, and normally we would think to protect the most fundamental right in our democracy, the courts would say, wait, you know, you need actual evidence of the problem you're trying to fix, not just speculation. But you're right. All it is here is speculation that fraud might occur. You know, of course, and they always point to a couple of isolated incidents or anecdotes and say, well, you know, you need to prove that it doesn't exist otherwise. And the other part of the calculation seems to get lost, which is, what are the harms that these voter restrictions create? And it makes it much more difficult for people to vote. You know, we don't really have any more a foundational or fundamental right to vote in a free and easy and equal manner because of all of the roadblocks that states like Texas and Georgia are putting up and the acquiescence of the federal courts in enacting those laws.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Douglas, who's a professor of law at the University of Kentucky College of Law, who teaches and researches election law and voting rights, civil procedure, constitutional law, and judicial decision making. And he's the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. And he has an article at CNN, Supreme Court Deals Blow to American Democracy. So, Josh, what did you make of the president's speech in Philadelphia today? Of course, site chosen for its historic value in terms of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, etc. He said, in going after the big lie, he said the power must always be with the people. And then with his voice rising, he said, have you no shame? Now, that kind of reminds me of the Army McCarthy hearings. How does it strike you?
You know, I'm of two minds about President Biden's speech. On the one hand, it was really great to see such a strong defense of our democracy, a strong statement, really passionate statement about the importance of the right to vote, the importance of breaking down barriers to the ballot box, which has really been our history of continuing evolution in making it easier for more and more groups to vote. So, you know, I thought the passion in his voice and his words was really meaningful to hear that from the president. At the same time, he basically just said we need to act. And yes, he said we need to pass the two bills that are pending before Congress, the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. But he didn't say how he would get it done. And right now, the Republicans in the Senate are saying that they're not going to even come to the table to negotiate at all. And so there was, I think, a disconnect between the lofty rhetoric, which was great, and tangible views or tangible action items for how to actually make it happen.
So do you think then there is something going on in private as opposed to this public speech today? Is he really on the phone to Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema? behind the scenes?
I hope so. I hope so. You know, I'm of the mindset that bipartisanship is a virtue when it comes to voting rules. You know, as you mentioned, I teach at the University of Kentucky, and I had a hand in helping to negotiate a bipartisan election bill that was passed earlier this year that both improves access to the ballot and increases security. And so it's kind of a win-win. And that's really a model, I think. And so, you know, I'm nervous about Democrats just going it alone if they don't at least try to get some sort of compromise first. But the Republicans need to come to the table as well. And, you know, I'm hopeful that President Biden is having those conversations so we can actually have some sort of reform package, because we do need to protect the right to vote. Whether there's behind the scene negotiations or not, I have no idea. But, you know, just saying the words "we need to act" is not enough. He actually needs to do something as well.
But it's difficult to understand the position that both Senators Sinema and Manchin are taking. Sinema wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post recently that made absolutely no sense. And I hope she's been subsequently educated about the history of the filibuster, which has no part in the Constitution itself. And in Manchin's case, it's difficult to understand as well. In both of them will be in the minority if they don't go along with voter reform, because there's no way that it, without voter reform coming from the Congress, that the two senators who won, at least one of them, Warnock, down in Georgia, they will get reelected because of all the voting suppression going on there and across the board. So their very fate hangs in the balance. That part I don't understand. Just simple self-interest.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way to couch what I think at least is Joe Manchin's views is that an election law is going to be much more legitimate if both sides have come to the table. That, you know, the Republican voter suppression measures are, you know, harmful for the right to vote, and you know, they have no good reason behind them. They're built on a lie, and they're really partisan based. It's very clear there's a partisan intent behind them, and the effect will be to make it harder for Democrats to win. And so is the answer, well, the Democrats should essentially do the same thing in the name of enhanced democracy and enhanced right to vote? And I fully understand and appreciate that argument. But if there were a way to reach some sort of compromise so that both sides could see the rules as legitimate, then I think that's better. And my guess is that that's what Manchin is at least hoping for. Because here's the fear, right? If the Democrats simply pass a unilateral law that's seen as unduly partisan by half of the country, then you get to the sorts of things that happened on January 6th, where no one believes in the rules of the game. You know, if you lose, it's only because the rules were stacked against you, and the only answer is violence. And so, you know, although the two sides are operating on very different planes in terms of voter suppression versus voter enhancement and preserving democracy as opposed to being against democracy, if there were a way to achieve more bipartisanship so that both sides saw the rules as legitimately enacted, then that leaves the democracy in a better place overall.
Well, I think the Texas legislators who are meeting with Manchin, and I imagine Sinema as well, they're basically saying, look, the only tool that we had left to stop this juggernaut of voter suppression in Texas was to deny quorum. And it seems the same as applies for the filibuster. It's the tool that the Republicans are using, you know, regularly, and not even in desperation, but as a matter of course. So do you think that's an argument that might reach Manchin and Sinema?
I mean, maybe, right? And I think the message has to be, look, try the compromise route and see if the Republicans will actually negotiate in good faith. And then if they won't, well, we need to preserve and protect our democracy. And so then take the starker path. And so my guess is that that's part of the conversations going on right now. Is that, yeah, you know, if we could achieve some sort of bipartisanship, again, like we did in Kentucky over voting rules, that's better for the overall legitimacy. But if Republicans are simply not going to even, negotiate at all, not even going to come to the table at all, well, you know, we shouldn't just let them in various states enact partisan, harmful rules that harm minority voting rights and the like. So my guess is that Manchin is sort of seeing this as a process. Now, whether that's completely naive, you know, it remains to be seen. It might just be that Mitch McConnell is saying no negotiations whatsoever on anything. And so this attempt to find some sort of compromise is a fool's errand. That may be where we end up. My guess is that's what he's sort of thinking.
Well, nothing was more personal to the senators and congressmen and women than what happened on January the 6th, where their lives were threatened. And yet the Republicans refused to join in a bipartisan attempt to investigate how it happened, why, and how to prevent it from happening again. So I think that was certainly a wake-up call for Manchin. Do you think that there's any other reasons apart from the arguments that they put forth about why they have to preserve the filibuster? As I mentioned, the op-ed that Sinema wrote really didn't make a lot of sense. And when Manchin justifies the filibuster as an important tradition, it actually is not in the Constitution. And the record seems to be so manifestly clear that it's been used as a tool of obstruction as opposed to a tool that is a last resort in order to maintain bipartisanship.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it's not in the Constitution, but there is a long history of Senate tradition using the filibuster, as you said, in the way that you mentioned, to try to achieve some measure of compromise. And my guess is that Manchin recognizes that the Democrats are one vote away from being in the minority, and so therefore the filibuster could be a useful tool if and when they're back in the minority. But I keep going back to this question of how do you prevent another January 6th? How do you prevent the losers of an election accepting defeat? And if they lose an election where the rules were all dictated by the other side, no matter how fair those rules seem to be to the other side, then the only answer is to resort to that violence. So my guess is that although some senators see it differently, senators like Joe Manchin, perhaps, and I can't put, you know, words or thoughts into his mouth, and I'm just speculating here, but I at least understand the notion that, look, if we can find a way to create rules that both sides agree to ahead of time, then it makes it much harder to say after you lose, well, the only reason I lost was because the rules were unfair, and so therefore I have to resort to violence. I mean, think about what Donald Trump did. He said throughout the entire campaign, the rules are stacked against me, and so if I lose, it's only because the rules were unfair. You have these Democratic governors and state Supreme Courts in Pennsylvania changing the rules to make it so that I lose, so that when he did lose, that's what he pointed to, and that, you know, led to an armed insurrection. And so, again, if I could create a utopian world, I'd love to have one in which bipartisanship was actually the expected norm so that the losing side would more readily accept defeat.
Well, Joshua Douglas, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Douglas, who's a professor of law at the University of Kentucky College of Law, who teaches and researches election law and voting rights, civil procedure, constitutional law, and judicial decision-making. And he's the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. And he has an article at CNN, Supreme Court Deals Blow to American Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the failure of our press in repeating rather than questioning reports coming from Haitian officials and politicians vying for power, whose claims about who was behind the assassination of President Moïse are completely lacking in credibility.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gary Pierre-Pierre, who's a Haitian-born Pulitzer Prize-winning multimedia and entrepreneurial journalist who left the New York Times in 1999 to launch the Haitian Times, a New York-based English-language weekly publication serving the Haitian diaspora. He is the co-founder of the City University of New York's Center for Community and Ethnic Media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Pierre-Pierre.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Gary. And your reporting seems to be so much more realistic than what we're hearing in much of the press. Much of the press is repeating statements from Haitian officials and politicians, and we know that there's not even any agreement amongst the three that are vying for power there. Why is it that we listen to these people? Because, frankly, most of the official statements have been very suspicious and not exactly credible.
Well, Ian, you're being very kind. They're not even suspicious. They're flat-out lies. What we know is that the president of Haiti was assassinated in his bedroom while his wife was shot and is now in Miami at Jackson Memorial Hospital Center, where she's still listed in critical condition. So those are the facts. Now, afterward, the government has taken a sort of like a page out of Donald Trump's playbook by bombarding people with false information and misinformation and disinformation. And we know Haiti, obviously this is the Haitian Times, and we know a lot of the players, and we know that what they're alleging is simply not true, what the government is alleging. And so we look at it very critically, as we should. But I have been imploring my colleagues from the mainstream media to be very careful, not to run with whatever they say, you know, check first before you go with it. I know it's a big story, it's a fluid story, but you know, we have to be journalists, not just accept the Haitian government's explanation and call them out when they don't hold up. And this is simply basic journalism, and I'm surprised that, you know, they are going for it, and it's unfortunate.
Well, the main thing that everybody's gone for is the idea that these mercenaries from Colombia are the assassins. And it's highly suspicious that no member of the president's bodyguards, the palace guards, were injured. Two of them actually were captured, apparently, by the Colombians. And we've learned from the Colombian media, from their newspaper Semana, that the top palace guard, Dimitri Harald, who is in charge of protecting President Moise, he had traveled repeatedly to Colombia in the months before the assassination. And he's also under investigation by U.S. authorities for arms trafficking. So as far as I know, the Haitian authorities haven't even interviewed these palace guards yet.
No, they haven't. In fact, they put them together. They left them together. They're not in isolation. Basically, cooking up stories after stories. Well, this is another complication in the story. The fact of the matter is the Haitian government had requested help from Colombia to help it with dealing with the gang problem that the country was facing. And so these guys, I believe, and they were there working for the government. As a matter of fact, this morning, a source of mine confirmed that the Colombians were responsible for dismantling one of the gangs in a suburb of Pétionville, a neighborhood called La Boule. So that's why the police were able to go to their house and arrest those guys. Now, who the actual killers are remain unknown. But one thing I know for sure, that these guys that they have been parading on television are not the killers, because it doesn't add up. If these guys are professional killers, they'll know, they'll have an exit strategy. And the other thing, Ian, these type of operations don't require 28, 30 people to carry out. It's 7, 8 or maximum people who would be part of a team tasked with something that, you know, sensitive. The assassination of a president is nothing small, even in Haiti. And so the pictures are muddled. What we're trying to figure out is what happened to the real murderers.
So, Gary, when you say that these Colombians were hired by the government, you mean Moise, right?
Yes, of course.
And so did he hire them because he was concerned about his own safety?
No. These guys were hired to help the Haitian police deal with the gang problem. They were not guarding Moïse. Ayrault's guy, the presidential palace guard, were tasked with protecting Moïse. And Ayrault was the leader, the head of that unit. And you mentioned something very important. I think we need to let your listeners know about this, right? Ayrault was under investigation for arms trafficking. Now, from my understanding, and I've seen it because the American government would never approve of such a move. Every appointment is clear to the embassy. That's a fact. Because I had a friend of mine who was, well, I knew him well. I don't know. And he was tasked to become Minister of the Interior. And the embassy said no, because this guy was under investigation for drug trafficking. He was paid to guard the drugs. He was not dealing, but he was letting drug transship through Haiti. And he was not hired as a minister. So this time, I don't know how the embassy would allow would let him do something like that. But I figured that since it's the presidential guard, they didn't say anything about it. But that's another question, another unclear area for us.
So it does look as if the Colombians are the fall guys, and they apparently arrived hours, at least an hour after Moyes was assassinated, and Moyes was tortured before he was riddled with bullets. He has a broken leg and lots of facial injuries. And one of the more obvious things, and I'm not necessarily suggesting this in any conspiratorial way, but Claude Joseph, who is the spokesman that people are listening to, he, of course, Ariel Henry was appointed by Moyes the day before he died. So you would logically, Claude Joseph is not happy with that appointment, right? And now they're fighting amongst themselves about who's actually in charge.
Well, the reality is, Ian, is that Ariel Henry is legally the prime minister because his nomination was published in the official government publication, Le Moniteur, the Monitor. Mm-hmm. And so the swearing in is just ceremonial. It's not legal or anything. Once it's published, you are effectively appointed. And it's a matter of somebody swearing him in. But I don't know that, again, what happened. But I think he took the helm and made a deal with the UN, who quickly proclaimed him prime minister and said they will work with him. And so hence the confusion. I think the UN's proclamation of legitimizing of Joseph has thrown this into some sort of chaos. But and I don't know how this fight is going to resolve, but it shouldn't even be a fight, frankly.
Well, there seems to be this another, we talk about Fall Guys, this character that the Haitian authorities have arrested, Christian Emmanuel Sanon. He is supposedly the guy that organized through a Florida-based company, CTU Securities, to hire these Colombians. He's, according to the Haitian government, he's the intellectual author of this assassination, but he doesn't look like anybody that would be that powerful enough, like an oligarch behind the scenes. I mean, one of the things that Amy Wallace says about Haiti, and she's written a number of books, is that it's the sort of ultimate 99% versus 1% country, where 99% of the people have nothing and 1% have everything.
I would even go further and say 0.5% has everything. It's not even 1% in the case of Haiti. And to your point about Sanon, this is a man, I don't know him personally, but I have a lot of close friends who know him. They describe him as a big talker who is bankrupt, who has no money whatsoever, went to Haiti to grift. Now, again, this is speculation on my part. What I'm about to say, I want to make it clear, is that I think he may have had contact with the company in Florida, and he recommended them. But him being architect of this, Absolutely not.
And what about the role of the gang leader, codenamed Barbecue? He's close to Moise, isn't he?
No, he's not the gang that's close to Moise. It's the other one, Phantom Nine. That's the one that's close to Moise, allegedly. You know, uh-huh. I don't have direct ties, but it's also, it's almost like it's known that, yes, that's the gang that Moise is allied with.
And they were behind the La Saline massacre?
Yeah, I mean, yes. And that was still shocking. Because I'm glad you're bringing this up, Ian, because what a lot of people fail to realize that this gang problem has virtually paralyzed Haiti for the last a year and a half or so. What they've done is they've really cut off the capital city, Port-au-Prince. It was dangerously perilous to try to go to the provinces from the north or the south, or risk getting kidnapped, or shot dead, or anything can happen to you trying to leave or come into the city. And that's been happening for a while. So this is the situation that Moise was trying to resolve. Then he turned south to Colombian experts because they have very good tactics to deal with gangs. And so that was the connection.
So who do you think wanted Moise dead and why?
Well, there are some names being thrown about, but I will not go into details because, again, I want to be very careful about what I say publicly. There are several people. One of the things that I have to say directly, that this was not a political assassination. This was a personal assassination, largely a business interest. He had been very aggressively trying to dismantle that 1% or 0.5%, as I put it, interest. He was trying to break up their monopolies on everything. And so he paid the ultimate price. But here's again, to model the situation once more. Moise was not the best messenger for that message because he was involved, with gang activity, being that you are the president and you have a gang ally with you. And he was also trying to muscle in and get his share of the deal. So in a way, while it might sound noble to go after these corrupt oligarchs, but he did it in a corrupt fashion himself.
And the fact that he was a banana exporter, that doesn't explain his wealth, right? He was making money out of siphoning off the Venezuelan oil and other things, right?
Well, you were researched, Ian. I'm impressed. Yes, he was. He was a serial entrepreneur. Was involved with all kinds of business, and he came out of nowhere to ascend to the presidency, just simply not ready for the position that he was in. He had no allies anywhere, and that's one of the reasons why he turned to a gang to show up his street support or whatnot. But in the end, you play footsie with gangsters, it doesn't end well for you.
Right. Well, it sounds like, as far as the corrupt Haitian elite of oligarchs, that he was kind of nouveau riche, and they didn't approve of him. Is that right?
No, they don't. They don't approve of any dark-skinned Haitian rising to any sort of prominence. There's no industry, you name it, in Haiti that's controlled by a dark-skinned person. They're not even allowed to get involved in that. Even Haitian Americans who try to do business in Haiti, ultimately they fail, not because they don't have the business skills or the acumen to run a business, but because the system is set up that for them to fail.
So just in the last couple of minutes, why does the United States support these people, these oligarchs, these light-skinned people that, again, Amy Bullence refers to as the morally repugnant elite?
Yes, the MREs. Well, yeah. Some of them went to the finest schools in America. They speak flawless English. And the Americans tend to congregate to the elite. And they know exactly what it is because this is not a secret what they're up to. But the Americans say, who cares? It's Haiti. That's the general attitude of embassy folks who are working there. They know, but hey, these guys, it is what it is. They're not going to change the system, and they let it go.
So do you expect anything now from, Biden is resisting the call to send troops down, which Claude Joseph is asking for. Do you think that finally the U.S. will change its policy, this zombie-like State Department policy of supporting these corrupt leaders and ignoring the 99.9% of the interests of the vast population who are being preyed upon by gangs and having the wealth of the country stolen, and they're basically suffering, and they have suffered for decades?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not optimistic that the U.S. will do anything about it. But the call for military intervention by Joseph is really regrettable, and no one has an appetite for it. The Haitian people don't want it. The Haitian diaspora doesn't want it. And Biden is reluctant. That's why he's reluctant, because he's not going to send U.S. troops. And also, think about this. Just the other day, he announced withdrawal from Afghanistan. He doesn't want American troops in, you know, all these places and whatnot. So on what basis would he justify to the American people to send troops to Haiti? And we don't support that. I think what he has done so far is what we call for. Have the FBI come in, investigate the situation, come out with the investigation, and then, you know, we'll accept it. I will be behind whatever the FBI puts out. I think it will be professional. It will be thorough. It will be credible. And we're going to have to accept it and move on based on what they find. And if they find some culprits, then they need to be arrested and tried for the crime.
Well, Gary Pierre-Pierre, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Gary Pierre-Pierre, who's a Haitian-born Pulitzer Prize-winning multimedia and entrepreneurial journalist who left the New York Times in 1999 to launch the Haitian Times, a New York-based English-language weekly publication serving the Haitian diaspora. He is the co-founder of the City University of New York's Center for Community and Ethnic Media. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the predictable crackdown on protesters in Cuba, with the shaken communist leaders resorting to their familiar tools of repression and tired revolutionary slogans as police and army flood the streets of the major cities. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ada Ferrer, who is a professor of history and Latin American and Caribbean studies at New York University, where she's taught since 1995. She's the author of Insurgent Cuba, Race, Nation, and Revolution, 1868 to 1898, winner of the Berkshire Book Prize for the best book by a woman in any field of history, and Freedom's Mirror, Cuba and Haiti in the Age of Revolution, which won the Frederick Douglass Book Prize from the Gilda Lehman Center at Yale University, as well as multiple prizes from the American Historical Association. Born in Cuba and raised in the United States, she has been traveling to and conducting research on the island since 1990, and her forthcoming book is Cuba, an American History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ada Ferrer.
Hi. Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And in terms of your new book, what kind of chapter would you write about what just happened over the weekend?
That's a great question. One of the issues with the book was where to end, right? The book goes from before the arrival of Columbus to the present, and the present keeps happening and history keeps happening. So that's always a tricky thing. I would write a chapter that would do what I try to do throughout the book, which is to keep in play and analyze the relationship between Cuba and the U.S. and the way one affects the other. And that's the relationship in both directions. And the other thing I would like to do in such a chapter would be to keep the focus on the Cuban people. So we tend to think of what's happening in Cuba in terms of grander geopolitics, the Cold War, a longstanding U.S.-Cuba conflict, but it's actually people on the street, in their homes, in their farms, and dining rooms, and bedrooms who are living these changes and these difficulties and these challenges. And so I would try to bring their perspective to the fore.
So in terms of what President Biden said in response to these demonstrations, expressing solidarity for the Cuban people, my understanding is that it doesn't necessarily resonate because the average Cubans feels that the embargo has hurt them as much as they feel alienated from their own government. So what's your reading on that? I mean, the embargo seems, has always seemed to be counterintuitive, because if you let people in, like the diasporas in particular, and let money in and let the exchange, I mean, that's the lesson we learned from the Cold War, is that the young Soviets and East Germans, etc., you know, it was rock and roll that brought down the Berlin Wall, not the number of missiles the U.S. had pointing at the Soviet Union.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. So I think Cuban people are smart. They know that the embargo hurts them. They've been particularly hurt by the recent tightening of the embargo under the Trump administration, which made it virtually impossible for them to get remittances from family, to receive visits from family because he stopped charter flights and even commercial flights to small cities. So income for the government, but for the average Cuban, decreased because of the tightening of the embargo under Trump. So they know that they are hurt by that, but they're smart and they know that things have more than one cause. And they, even as they ascribe some of the blame to the U.S., they ascribe perhaps more blame, I think, to their own government. So they point out things like the government says there's no money, but they're building these fancy new hotels, but there's no food. Or, for example, even with the COVID response, which in many ways in the beginning was, well, throughout in many ways, has been an exemplary public health response in some regard. The government worked on five candidates for a vaccine. They have two that are promising and that they're administering, but there is no aspirin and there are no antibiotics. So I think they don't trust that their government has set the right priorities. They don't trust that the government is interested in meeting even their most basic needs. And so I think for most Cubans can keep both those things in perspective. They know the embargo hurts them, and they believe the Cuban government does as well.
Well, the demonstrators ransacked these government-run stores that only accept foreign currency, where you can buy just about anything. But the average Cuban doesn't have the money. They've only got pesos. And the stores that take pesos have nothing to sell.
Exactly.
So you can see the frustration there as well. Right. And some of the demonstrators caught on camera were saying things exactly what you said. You know, how come the government's building luxury hotels, but we're starving?
Yeah. And I've heard things like that in Cuba for a long time. And it's interesting because, as you know, or as you probably know, there were major demonstrations in Havana in 1994, in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union, during what Cubans call the special period, which was a period of terrible austerity and scarcity and so on. And during those demonstrations, they also attacked precisely those stores, the stores that sold in hard currency and that had supplies that most of them couldn't access. And I think that some people have made the comparison between what's going on now and what happened in 1994 with the demonstrations. I think that's true to a good extent, but I feel like these demonstrations are more significant in part because they're happening 30 years later. So people are that much more tired of never recovering economically. They're that much more tired of being told to wait for things to get better. They're tired of being told this is just a transitional period and things will improve. So I think it's an accumulated frustration that we saw in the protests over the weekend.
So when the Soviet Union collapsed and Cuba went through the austerity period, and there were similar demonstrations. And as you mentioned, they attacked the same targets, these stores that have everything that you could buy, except you have to buy them with foreign currency, which the average Cuban doesn't have. The authorities then, of course, cracked down mercilessly then, and now the authorities are doing what they do. It's an authoritarian state where the police are now back in the streets, on every street corner. The army's coming in, and they're arresting all kinds of people, and kids are in hiding. They've shut down all of the social media, Telegram, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. So that's a predictable response. It worked back then when the Soviet Union collapsed. Will it work again?
That's unclear. When the Soviet Union collapsed, there were other places, other things to turn to. They could turn, for instance, to tourism and build a tourist industry. They're trying to focus on that now, but you're still in the middle of the global pandemic, and it's unclear whether they can, you know, they can recover to adequate levels. Also, as I said, because that was 30 years ago, people had, it was the first major, there have been economic troubles before, but it was something so unprecedented in 1994. But because there's never been a full recovery, people are that, but the frustration is just building. So it's unclear whether the frustration will be enough to keep people protesting. The other thing that's different is that in 1994, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have social media. And the government, as you said, is trying to restrict it now, but people are trying to do workarounds. We'll see how that goes. It's too soon to tell. And then finally, the other thing that is different, and I've said this before in some other interviews, is that the Cuban population is remarkably young. About over a third were born after the fall of the Soviet Union. So they have no experience of an era of relative plenty before the special period. They have, their whole lives have been marked by economic crises to greater or lesser extent, right? So I think that they are not convinced that there will be something better coming down the road. And that might make them less willing to, or more willing to keep trying to protest and rise up. The other thing that Castro did in 1994 was to tell people that they could leave and that the Cuban government wouldn't stop them. So part of what happened in 94, right in the midst of that protest, was the rafter crisis, which brought about 35,000 people to the U.S., many more who left and were never made it and were never found. But it was a massive, dramatic exodus in a remarkably short period of time. So that's, in some ways, he got rid of some discontents in that way. And the number of people trying to flee by sea is increasing now. So you're seeing reports every few days of rafters arriving in the Florida Keys or the Florida shore. So that's been picking up over the last couple of months as well.
And of course, you mentioned Fidel Castro, his brother Raul, who took over from him after Fidel Castro stepped down. He was in meetings on Sunday with the Political Bureau to address what they call provocations.
Right.
So again, you're talking about these aging revolutionaries. I mean, the motto, of course, was what, fatherland or death? And the rap song, yep, that's out there now, that's got the government of Cuba so up in, you know, so right, apoplectic, is a play on those words. Right. Patria e vida, right?
Right.
That turned it around to fatherland or life. So yeah, that exactly would indicate to me, back to the analogy with the Soviet Union collapsing because of rock and roll, not because of missiles, that seems to be an example of that, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And the video and the song are really a brilliant, they're a brilliant move. The motto that you refer to and that they're kind of playing against is, as you said, fatherland or death, patria o muerte, which which Fidel Castro began using to end speeches and as a slogan in 1960. And it's been used throughout during the special period when, after the fall of the Soviet Union and when Eastern Europe, abandoned the course of state socialism, he also added socialism or death as an extra. And now these young musicians and lyricists came up with this song that is, on the face of it, a very kind of common sense plea. Why do we have to choose between homeland or death? We want homeland and life. And it's a the video is very professionally done, has very high production value, and I haven't been to Cuba since the pandemic started. So my last time there was at the very end of 2019. But that's what people were chanting. People know the song.
So did the authorities go after the singer?
Yeah, several of them have been arrested over time. There are many of them are part of this. They're not all in Cuba. Some of the members are involved with a group called the Movimiento San Isidro. San Isidro is a neighborhood in Old Havana, a popular neighborhood, not well off, and a group of young artists there has been protesting for over a year, actually close to 2 years, against restrictions on freedom of expression. And so some of the musicians are part of that group. And they, when one of them was arrested last year, there were protests for his release that resulted in actually another remarkable protest November 27th of 2020, in which all these young people showed up at the Ministry of Culture and sat outside and refused to leave until the government met with them, until the culture minister met with them to talk about freedom of expression and art and thought, et cetera. And at first it seemed like the government was going to comply, and some of them were asked in, and another meeting was going to happen, and negotiations were going to happen. And then Miguel Díaz-Canel, the president, a couple days later, came out and said no negotiation. So that was a moment when there seemed a possibility of something, but the president shut it down. And with this protest over the weekend, he shut it down. I mean, he tried to shut it down right away, right? So I think people, Cubans I know, were just shocked to hear him say, revolutionaries to the streets, the order for combat is given. And they were shocked at that, understandably, I think.
Well, this is the old dictator's playbook, isn't it? The people that they're most afraid of are free thinkers, artists, musicians. And I'm always astounded that supporters on the left in the Europe and in the United States of people like Castro and company don't understand that the people that they arrest and suppress are people like their own friends, the people you hang out with. Yeah. A lot of my friends are writers and artists and actors and stuff, musicians. Right. They're the first people that get busted in these authoritarian states like Russia and Cuba. I mean, I've been puzzled by that.
Right, but I think there's a reason for it, and that is that Cuba has a very particular relationship with the United States. And the United States in Cuba has acted nefariously, so there is no doubt about that, over many, many years, right? So Cuba had a 30-year war for independence against Spain. It was close to victory, and the Americans came in during the Spanish-American War. And Americans always saw that as a benevolent act, right? The U.S. helping Cuba achieve its independence. Cubans, or many Cubans, and Cuban intellectuals and historians and writers, and precisely the kind of people you're talking about, always identified that move as a kind of theft. The United States came in and turned this progressive, popular, multiracial, multi-class movement for independence into an opportunity for the U.S. to defeat Spain. And then the U.S. occupied Cuba militarily for about 4 years. And then it would only leave if the Cubans agreed to incorporate as an appendix to their constitution something called the Platt Amendment, which gave the U.S. the right to intervene militarily in Cuba pretty much at will, and the U.S. did several times in the decades that followed. So I think in Cuba there is such a strong, historically nationalist, patriotic sentiment, and that is what Fidel Castro used when he came to power. And he used it to very good effect. And he was able to do that precisely because this history existed. And I think that this Cuban anti-imperialism in this moment of the Cold War, as parts of the world were becoming decolonized for the first time, gained a lot of adherence around the world, including among the European, Latin American, and American left. So it had, I think it has more to do with the particular role of the U.S. in Cuba and of the U.S. in the world, I would say.
And we still haven't shaken that legacy. Biden still has the same policies that Trump, and the State Department still supports these crooks down in Haiti, denies the majority of the people democracy. So it's an American disease, it seems.
And yeah. History is a complicated thing, you know. It's like it's sediment, right? There's these layers of it, and you can't just wish them away. And you have to deal with them and understand the way their legacies shape people's understanding of possibilities.
Well, Ada Ferrer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ada Ferrer, who's a professor of history and Latin American and Caribbean studies at New York University, where she has taught since 1995. She's the author of Insurgent Cuba, Race, Nation, and Revolution, 1868 to 1898, with a winner of the Berkshire Book Prize for the best first book by a woman in any field of history, and Freedom's Mirror, Cuba and Haiti in the Age of Revolution, which won the Frederick Douglass Book Prize from the Gilda Lehrman Center at Yale University, as well as multiple prizes from the American Historical Association. She was born in Cuba and raised in the United States and has been traveling to and conducting research on the island since 1990. And her forthcoming book is Cuba, an American History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate. where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 disappeared by